up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass. Working your fingers right down to the bone. And the guy behind you won't leave you alone. Ring, ring goes the bell. The cook in the lunchroom's ready to sell. You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat. Back in the classroom, open your books. Gee, but the teacher don't know how mean she looks. Soon as 3 o'clock rolls around, you finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the halls and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long you've been wanting to dance.
Good morning. My name is Carol Corbett Burris, and I'm the Executive Director of the Network for Public Education Action, based right here in New York City. And this is Talk Out of School, a show where we focus on issues affecting public schools here in New York City, in New York State, and also nationally. And we want you to enter the dialogue, too. So be sure to call in at the 10:30 break at 212-209-2877. Again, that's 212-209-2877. You know, listeners, right now, over 13% of our New York City students are immigrant students for whom English is a new language. My guests today are two of New York City's finest English as new language teachers, Arthur Goldstein and Ayxa Rodriguez. Arthur teaches English as a new language at Francis Lewis High School in Queens, where he's also a UFT chapter leader. He represents high schools on the UFT Executive Board. Arthur's writing has been featured in the New York Daily News, the Huffington Post, Gotham Gazette, City Limits, and elsewhere. And you really need to follow his blog. It's very funny and very informative. And you can find that at NewYorkCityNYCEducator.com, NYCEducator.com. Ayxa Rodriguez is an English as new language teacher and at the New York City DOE, and she has been teaching English as a second language for 14 years. She's a member of the MORE Caucus of the steering committee. She's a steering committee member, and MORE stands for Movement of Rank and File Educators. It's Caucus of the UFT. She was born and raised in the Bronx and educated in the New York City public schools. She attended LaGuardia High School for Music and Art and the Performing Arts. The main issues that she worries about all of the time are the instruction of English as new language students due to the Part 154 regulations, inequities for immigrant students, high-stakes testing, and other forms of opportunity hoarding and narrow education experience. Welcome, Arthur, and welcome, Ayxa.
Thank you, Carol.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. Now, before we talk about instruction for our English language learners, I'd like to touch on another topic. I'm like going crazy as I finish reading this article in the American Prospect this morning, making the argument that, you know, voting blue no matter what is not a good idea. Focus of it, of course, is on the candidacy of Michael Bloomberg and all of the flaws that he has as a candidate running on the or trying to get the Democratic nomination. And I know that there's a big history when it comes to New York City public schools and Michael Bloomberg. And I'm wondering if both of you might want to talk about that a little bit.
You want to go first, Ayxa?
Oh, boy. You want me? You sure you want to follow me?
I think we're going to say the same thing or essentially the same thing. You know, The argument is vote blue no matter who, but it's like vote blue no matter how misogynist, no matter how anti-labor, no matter how racist, no matter how megalomaniacal. It's like they're giving us Trump with a blue button on him, and it's very hard to take. I don't know. I worked through all 12 years of Bloomberg. I guess you did too, and. You know, he tried to break our union in various ways. The small Ikes and I were just on the phone before. We were talking about how he created these small schools and filled them with newbies who didn't have tenure and therefore avoided institutional memory and avoided any presence of union and managed to. I go to hearings for class sizes all the time because I'm in the most overcrowded school in the city. And I would meet people who were there, and they were not chapter leaders. They would say, my principal sent me to represent the school. And it was very odd because we are adversarial to principals when we're at those meetings, and going to represent your principal was just so odd for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting that you talk about the small schools. My husband became a teacher in New York City as a second career, and he was in a large comprehensive high school, and he could see at the end they were just trying. Joel Klein was just trying to undermine that school, trying to get it to do worse, putting in a principal who really just didn't know what they were doing, who was afraid of the kids, lower and lower scoring kids going into the school. And then lo and behold, they split it into four schools. He was one of the teachers in one of those new schools, Williamsburg Prep. And yeah, scores went up. But what he said was, you know, these were not the same kids. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was part of the whole idea of gentrification, which frankly I think is just whitification. It's code for that. That was happening in the Williamsburg area. I mean, did you see that in other parts of the city?
Well, as a small school teacher, I saw something different. It was definitely, there was some coded language when it came to people saying how great the small schools were and how you can give the kids so much more attention. What they were really meaning is that certain kids are difficult, and we're going to warehouse them in certain areas. And if the school fails, we'll keep churning and churning. So there were plenty of these campus schools that had six or more schools in it, right? And if the school closed, another one popped up. And the same number of fights would happen. The same number of problems would happen. But it was now split among six, so you can't even tell what was happening, because you would see that, oh, this school has less problems. Well, really, the whole building still had the same number of problems. So there was lots of games being played. It was definitely moving the chairs around. But the worst thing was that all of these changes had a disastrous effect on the opportunities for a lot of children. They narrowed the curriculum, killed CTE programs, killed, you know, hands-on things, and started to create this shuffling of certain types of students into certain types of schools worse than it ever had been. Because you would go by a theme, these themes, and you would end up seeing an interesting situation happen in a building where that's the white school, that's the Latino school, that's the immigrant school, because each of these themes created segregation and reinforced this idea that you got to put these kids in these categories. And
yeah,
I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah,
that's
think
what happened in the Bronx.
I'm absolutely certain that that's what happened. And, you know, one of the things that I observed, too, during those years, and I mean, I was on Long Island, so I was just seeing this from afar, was the whole idea of screened schools really emerging.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if the two of you could talk about perhaps what the motivation was behind that.
I just spoke to a couple of teachers and parents about it, but go ahead, Arthur.
It's not a great challenge to have good results when you select all the students. You know, there was a story in the Times about Carmen Fariña, principal, that always fascinated me. She changed all the teachers and she changed all the students and made the school a success. But the school, you know, the school wasn't the same school. It's the same thing you were talking about before. I just want to add something to what Aixa was talking about the small schools. I'm in the largest school in Queens. I'm in the most overcrowded school in the city. But this year I've got small classes. I've got four classes of about 16 to 18 students. And my classes are lovely. I mean, I don't have to discipline like I might have to. If there were 34 students, that's the maximum, I would have to shut down students often to allow others to participate. But I almost never have to do that in my classes now. I let the students be who they are. And I think they're enjoying it. And I think they're learning to love English because they just happen to be in a place where I'm the only person who teaches the beginners, and if we were to have only one section, there would not be enough room for them. And we just got lucky, and there are two sections, and there's just barely above what there would be for one section. That's good for these kids. What's bad is that the testing that we use places students way too high. I guess we're getting away from talking about Bloomberg, but I taught an advanced class last year, and these students had tested out of ESL, and they had also passed the English Regents grades in the high 80s, and they were unable to produce sentences that were coherent in English. It was a horrifying experience for me. I did not become familiar with the English Regents exam, the most recent iteration, until last year, and it doesn't test reading, and it doesn't test writing. It tests common coreiness, which is, I'm not sure, the quality. We're looking to...
There's a whole other rabbit hole right there. Well, you're right. You're right about the NYFA slat, and you're right about the new ELA. Mm-hmm. Not bueno.
You know, it's very interesting. I watched that test as it emerged, and yeah, I did want to thank you, Arthur, because I was going to segue right into English as a new language instruction and all of the issues that the kids are having to face now. And that English Regents went under the Common Core and John King and Merrill Tisch, and we can all remember those days. That went from an exam that was, you know, a fairly decent exam to one that became so difficult, what wound up happening, and so long that they had to keep lowering the score to a point where you can pass that exam essentially if you guess on the multiple choice part, and then just learn a rote formula in order to be able to do the essay, the short answer part of the test. So what you're seeing is, you know, a lowering of the bar so low everybody, you know, can walk under it, yeah, essentially. And so that's what's happening. It really is not a tool that should be used to decide whether or not a child needs ENL services.
Oh, absolutely not. I don't even know what the purpose of it is. I am mystified as to it. We used to have, when I started teaching, there was a test called the RCT for students who supposedly couldn't pass English Regents. And the RCT required you to write a persuasive essay. I mean, maybe a five-paragraph persuasive essay. But it required you to come up with an idea and develop the idea. And this test does not even do that. It gives you a bunch of other people's ideas about a topic you're likely not remotely interested in and ask you to, you know, regurgitate these ideas and say which ones are better, argument A or argument B, or pro or con for things like shark netting, which I had never thought about until I read the article, and I'm sure my students never think about either and are not remotely interested in.
Now, what level do you teach?
I usually
am in a small school.
Yeah. What grade levels?
I teach all of the grades. I teach all the subjects because I'm the one teacher that is full-time at the school. So I have six co-teachers. I have co-taught government, economics, U.S. history, and global. as well as pushing into regular English and having my own classes. So it's been an interesting thing that they've changed the way ESL is delivered and given a less of a quality education to the kids through these changes. And it's interesting to think that we're talking about testing and then Bloomberg and all these things, because we're judging the value of the changes and the success of his changes without discussing that the the tests are completely different. The ELA, when I took it, was a two-day test, required informational essay plus a regular literary analysis essay. You have to write something based on a critical lens quote.
Right.
And you have to come to the test knowing literature. So it required teachers to teach books. Now all teachers are being told is, here, do the excerpt, do an excerpt, do an excerpt. I just got a PD from a New York City Department of Education person saying, yeah, excerpts are enough. You don't have to teach the whole book.
Wow.
And this is what we're doing to our kids. Yet we're saying, oh, we're so successful. Kids are graduating so much more. But it's fake. It's false. Ask any of the college professors that we know that are in our network that are saying, yeah, these kids are collapsing in their first year. They don't know how to write independently. They can't, you know, do research on their own. They haven't read enough books. They're not getting historical or literary allusions. They can't follow classroom discussion because they should have gotten that in high school. Yet we claim that small schools were more successful. And people talk about the, you know, 18, 20 is the perfect class size, right? It's great. You can talk to the kids. The kids can talk to each other. They can still do group work, et cetera, et cetera. And I've been at plenty of small schools where I'm still getting 27, 34 kids in a room. So the illusion that small schools means small classrooms doesn't always happen. Arthur's in a big school, and he's got a small classroom, depending on the number of kids, their level, and how it gets scheduled. But what I'm noticing is that small schools do not have the capacity to program these kids correctly. And through no fault of their own, these ESL kids of their own are getting misprogrammed, and they're taking 5-6 years to graduate. So there's a lot more problems that people are not addressing, but we want to pat people on the back for these so-called innovations that were really union-busting innovations. That's what small schools were. And we have some progressive people who get sensitive because they had pushed for small schools, but small schools in their own building is fine. Six schools sharing a campus is
nuts. It's nuts, yeah.
Limiting language, limiting all the courses they can take, and forcing them into a narrow, like, it literally is a pipeline to graduation if they can get there.
I know. You know, it's so interesting because Arthur and I were going back and forth about this. As you guys know, I was a high school principal on Long Island. And when I would think about the ENL classes, I would think about those classes the same way I thought about special education classes. You have to keep them small. I laugh when Arthur says, well, small is, you know, 17 or whatever. I was always like, okay, we need to keep these classes under 8. Right? Because,
wow.
And I think that
would be a miracle in New York City.
No, I know. But I mean, when you think about the job, and the listeners need to understand this, you know, you'll have ENL classes. We're not talking about children who only speak one language as their first language, right? There can be within classrooms children that speak multiple languages. So you'll have a child whose first language is Spanish, another one is Chinese. It's, you know, I mean, has that been your experience in New York City?
Yeah, well,
New York City is very different than upstate. My kids, your kids, what, they speak mostly Asian languages? Because I have a lot of Africans.
We are dominated by Chinese at Francis Lewis High School. Yeah, that is our largest group. But in the last few years, we've gotten a little more diverse, which is good for the kids. I just like to say, you know, why is IEXA teaching social studies and I don't remember economics, whatever it is she's teaching, when she could be putting these kids together and teaching them English? We went to IEXA and I in 2015. We went to, I think it was George Washington campus, and we saw Betty Rosa. And one of the things that really stuck with me, she said, was, well, we really want to give these kids a subject, and she seemed to imply that English was not a subject. And I believe that is what is at the core of why IEXA, and not just IEXA, but many, many teachers are running around teaching multiple subjects rather than English, because the geniuses in Albany have determined that English is not a subject. They've actually written this in some of their books. There's a book called Teaching Advanced Literacy Skills, in which they say it's an outdated guiding assumption or principle that the strengths and needs of elves and their classmates are distinct and necessarily demand different approaches. They find that outdated. Yet, our students don't know English, and the other students do know English, and that is a fundamental difference. I don't think it's outdated. If English is not a subject, then Spanish is not a subject, then Chinese is not a subject, and we should just take the American kids and teach them, you know, biology in Chinese and hope for the best, because that's the approach they're taking to our elves right now.
It's one thing to say that you can learn English through the vehicle of a content. It's quite another to do that simultaneously by taking away the ESL class.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems that we have is this the political correctness game changing of names. We TESOL, ESL,
mm-hmm.
EFL, ENL. And when you go to the other side of the rest of the United States, they don't do this game. You know, and now I laugh. I'm getting a professional development, and the lady in front of me can't figure out if the kids are ELLs or ENLs or MNLs, and she's confused herself. And it's the most ridiculous thing. And I was like, how about human beings? How about children of God? Mm-hmm. Because here you are saying that because X, Y, and Z, we're going to give you a narrow curriculum. We're not going to give you the tools that you need to succeed. I took the kids to Sophie Davis, like, opening thing. We went to a nice little college thing. And the kids are really interested in medicine. And the only barrier is their language. We went to McDonald's afterwards. One of my students didn't know how to order.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean,
basic communication is being robbed from them because some people think, oh, it's better to just make them just do academic stuff. They have trouble mm-hmm. making friends. They don't really know how to do an interview for college. I have to prep them. The kids have only been here for 2 years, had to take a TOEFL, and no one told them. And because I don't have an advanced class, because those kids don't need nothing.
Well,
they have to do this by themselves.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous. And I remember, too, I was a Spanish teacher, so I had an understanding of how long, because I learned Spanish as my second language, and how long that took me, and the different levels and the processes and the immersion that's needed. And, you know, when I became principal, I remember, you know, gathering this group of folks, and I said, look, what we need to do, when it just comes, and this is high school level I'm talking, when it comes to the newcomer student who does not have a rudimentary grasp of the English language, let's think about a 5-year plan. Let's think about that first year being a year where we really try to help kids master English so that we're thinking about, you know, having 3 or more classes specifically in that, and then the other classes being things like art and music, even mathematics, that are not language heavy classes. And there was a woman there, I think she was from the BOCES, and she was like up in my face, and oh no, you're depriving kids of opportunity and you need to put them in, you know, living environment. And I'm like, what planet are you from? The vocabulary is so difficult. Sit right in a Chinese class that's teaching biology, and just see how well you do. And it was such a shame. So what I did as a principal was, yeah, I kind of went underground with it, and I started seriously thinking about 5-year plans for kids who were newcomers. And guess what? They graduated, and they graduated in 5 years, and they actually, you know, had some mastery of the language by the time they left the high school.
Good. It's good if you have a principal who will support you. I have to say, you know, I'm the chapter leader, so I clash with my principal on a lot of things, but he's actually very good with the L's. My assistant principal is very good with the L's. They understand. In our school, we have Title I, and we are over-serving our L's, from which they benefit. But because I'm on the executive board, and because I write the blog, a lot of people contact me, and I hear, I know IXA. I know an elementary teacher who has 9 co-teachers. That beats IXA, and he tells me that that's common around where he is. The idea is now
elementary level.
Oh no!
For a bad principal who doesn't care, you just dump the person in. You know, I dump an ESL teacher into my social studies class 2 days a week, and therefore the L's are somehow magically learning about the Battle of Gettysburg.
Because of the minute.
You know what? If you guys would have, if you guys would, yeah, if you wouldn't mind, I accept. It talk a little bit about what when Arthur uses the term, could I think that some of our listeners probably don't. What is a co-teacher?
So right now, under Part 153, because it makes us look like we give injections or do pedicures. What we do is we go into a classroom and we are supposed to, in the ideal perfect world, know the curriculum, know the unit, have co-planned the unit, co-planned the lesson, and deliver part of the lesson, work in small groups, and use the different co-teaching like scenarios. So the parallel teaching, you know, different alternative teaching, groupings, different like that. The idea is that an extra teacher in there focusing on language is supposed to get a result through the vehicle of the content. Never happens. Hot mess. Always trying to assume that just one outlier example makes it a successful method. It doesn't. Because what ends up happening is you can have mismatched teachers, no co-planning, different philosophies, content teachers who will not slow down for the L, and mm-hmm. who will not modify materials for the L. You end up having conflicts, having to have principals and assistant principals moderate the conflicts, breaking the contract, because now we're having principals looking at our units and our lesson plans in a deeper way because teachers are not getting along. It's right. Placing me in a classroom where this teacher believes they have to get them ready for the region, so will not slow down, yeah. Will not teach writing, will not focus on a skill because they just want to do content all day long. That's not serving the kids in the way they're supposed to be serving, and that's what's really happening. The integrated minutes are the minutes where the kids have a co-teacher, right? The standalone minutes are the ones where us ESL teachers are all by ourselves, right? Then you have the flexible minutes, right? All these different minutes and how it's broken down, how the kids get their so-called service, okay? That's what confuses a lot of schools because they may not be able to do this, which is why they may have an ESL teacher up to 9 or more co-teachers, because if one group of kids only needs 90 minutes, the other needs 180, the another group 360, and then the last one, the beginners, need 540, you have that teacher popping in, doing nothing but translating and holding up the wall.
Wow.
And they're getting a full salary, and they're not being treated as full teachers. And people keep using the word service because that's the label that the state says. Well, I'm a teacher. I didn't go in there to be told, oh, you're going to go in there for 180 minutes in a week and you've performed the service through osmosis. Because that's exactly what it is. My body in a space equals that they're able to double count. They can go and tell the U.S. Department of Education that they're serving kids when really it's just my body in the space.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because it sounds like what they did was they took the special education inclusion model and they put it on top of the English language learners model. You know, that can work. I mean, I could see that working in our school when we worked with special education kids. But this is a whole other ball game because you're talking about children who don't know what's going on.
It really is.
Right? They don't know the language.
Talk about the way the laws are not made to work properly. I am in a room sometimes when I have some kids who are both. And so, therefore, now there's three teachers in a room and the para. There's no place to be. There's no way four of us can lead a lesson. And you end up having, because four adults in a room, the amount of voices when people try to have small groups in a tiny room, you can hardly hear yourself.
Right.
You end up having to pull out a group. So it's no longer an integrated group. In order for them to hear themselves, I have to pull them out.
Yeah.
So now you have four different groups pulled out in whatever empty classroom. So it's a lie. It is a lie. And the reality is that what we all need is we all need to know about special ed and we all need to know about ASL. And if you wanted to give me the teaching of English, like any language, then I can do the teaching of English. I shouldn't have to. I mean, know history, but I shouldn't have to be there teaching a history class when that was not what my master's degree was. And people may say, oh, that's the old way of teaching ESL. I started teaching English as a foreign language in Japan. They would never do that.
Our language here. We'll use mierda, okay, so nobody knows. We have to take a quick break. Guys, okay. This is fabulous. We're going to be back, so you have to stay there. We're going to take a quick break. I'm talking language instruction for our New York City English language learners with two of New York City's finest teachers, Arthur Goldstein and Aixa Rodriguez. We want you now to enter the dialogue, so be sure to call in at 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877. We'll be right back after the break.
With the one you love, you're making romance. All day long, you've been wanting to dance. Feeling the music from head to toe. Round and round and round you go. Hail, hail, rock and roll. Deliver me from the days of old.
This is Phil Donahue. I have 600 channels in my home, but 400 of them are selling the Bowflex machine. That's why I listen to WBAI New York.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI in New York.
Hi there. This is Carol Corbett-Burris again with Talk Out of School. I am still with my guests, Arthur Goldstein and Aixa Rodriguez, and we're going to continue to talk about the importance of sound instruction for immigrant students who have recently arrived to the United States and are not fluent in English. I want to sort of step back again, because we're talking, we understand that we're part of it, but some of our listeners have not. So I'm going to give you both a model. This is what it looked like when I was a principal. I was not so long ago. Child arrives, they know no English at all. They had three full periods of English as a second language instruction. There was a test that they took to measure their fluency. It was pretty difficult. And if they did, you know, pretty good on the test, then that dropped down to two periods of instruction. If they did really well on it, it dropped down to one, and then eventually it became support. They had full periods of learning English in a room with a teacher who was designated to do that, and then the rest of their day, they took other courses, subject matter courses. Tell me what the model looks like now. Arthur?
Okay, so under Part 154, as it is now, your three periods that they take, at least one of them has to be under a co-teaching model. And two of them can be under a co-teaching model. So that means you have reduced their direct English instruction by at least 33%, by up to 66%. Beyond beginners, one period may be direct English instruction, but doesn't have to be. Once they are no longer beginners, you may reduce their direct English instruction by a factor of 100%.
Wow.
The only good thing that was in the new iteration of Part 154 was that students who had tested out of ESL would have to get English support, but New York City, in its infinite wisdom, found ways to get around it. One of them was taking an AP course. So students at Francis Lewis High School, a Chinese-speaking student, could take AP Chinese and thereby be released from getting any instruction in English whatsoever. Essentially, they have reduced direct English instruction in high schools by a factor of 33% to 100%. I'm looking at two books right now that UFT gave me. One's called Cultivating Knowledge, Building Knowledge. It's about L's. And that studies students from grades 1 to 6. The other is like the Bible of the new thing that's coming in called Teaching Advanced Literacy Skills. And that studies students grades 1 to 8. And Aixa and I both teach high school. And it's pretty well known by anybody who studies language acquisition that your ability to acquire language precipitously declines around puberty.
Yeah.
And the fact that they are only considering younger students, I think it is really important. I'm not saying it works in elementary school because it doesn't work there either, but that's who they considered. They never considered us at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that at the elementary level, while it's not a perfect model, listeners should realize when you're talking about the vocabulary that's happening, the subject matter that's happening, you know, it's a lot simpler. It is not as complex. It is not as difficult. The elementary classroom, I think, lends itself a little bit more to other teachers pushing in and doing some co-teaching. But high school, it's just insane because, I mean, you don't have to have, any mastery of the language of the kids you're teaching in order to be an ENL teacher, do you?
No, you don't. No, I mean, no. I have seen teachers who translate, but if you can only, I can speak Spanish, but I can't speak Spanish in my classroom because that would be favoring the Spanish speakers and ignoring the Chinese and Korean and Bengali speakers and everybody Spanish speakers.
Go ahead, Aisa.
He teaches by himself, so he's good. I don't. I'm in someone else's classes, and I'm trying to get these kids who have low-level literacy in their own language and, like, entering understanding or merging understanding in English to understand complex content. So that means I have to do side-by-side translations. I have to have glossaries. I have to get materials and gloss them on the side. I have to do anything I can in multiple languages. I may talk to my colleagues. We have some language pairs. I may try the dreaded Google Translate. So my understanding of Spanish allows me to follow along with the French that I have to do for my African Francophone speaking students. And I have to do this because they can't keep up with the pace. And that's one of the models that they tell us to do. Oh, use the L1 as a support for L2. But, you know, you speak to Honningsfeld and Dove, the authors, the professor authors of this co-teaching for ELS out of Malloy College, and they will tell you, oh, but it's great, it's great. We saw somewhere in Indiana or some other place where it works. And when I have six different languages in one room, you know, it gets to be a lot of work on me because now I have to know someone else's subject, make sure I can get glossaries and support things to help this kid understand the Tier 2 and Tier 3 words. It is a lot of work. I am working 10 times harder, more burnt out now than ever. And this is at the beginning of the destruction of our career path because this license is not going to last.
No.
It allowed for a 15 credit extension for content area teachers and accounting that extension as ESL instruction.
And you know,
we're under attack.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting too, because I remember, and I bet you anything, it's still the case, especially now in this time of overall teacher shortage, because of people like Mike Bloomberg that hammered on teachers for so many years. Even back in the day when there were a decent amount of teachers, it was very, 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 very difficult to find teachers that were certified in English as a second language. And frankly, a lot of the ones who were, they didn't want anything to do with high school. You know, they wanted to be doing the work with the little ones. So I really commend both of you for everything, you know, that you're doing for kids. So if you were going to, before we open up the lines for questions, if you were going to describe what you think would be the perfect program, the one that would work the best for the children, what would that program look like?
I think we need to roll back the changes to part 154. They are not productive. You know, what Aisa describes is just absolute chaos. And I understand she needs to translate, but translating is not actually teaching English. She's doing this because there's nothing else she could do because they're not leaving her alone to teach. In our school, we pair ESL with English, and I'm certified in English. So I'm lucky that I don't need a co-teacher, and about half of my colleagues have gone back and gotten their English certification, so they don't have to sit while an English teacher is teaching To Kill a Mockingbird to a group of students who don't speak English. But I know that this has happened. It's happened repeatedly, and my colleagues have complained of it, and that's why they went and got their certification. We need to understand that learning a language is a big deal, mm-hmm. and learning a language is fundamental, and passing tests is not as important as taking your grandmother to the doctor or going to buy a pizza or looking for a girlfriend or trying to talk to people. And that, you know, it's true that these things can occur without instruction. And it's true that, you know, your great-grandfather came here and maybe didn't need instruction and, you know, sold things on the street. But that's sink or swim, and we've moved past that, and we know better than that. We ought not to be moving back toward it, and that's what Albany and the geniuses in Albany are moving us toward, and it's disgraceful and unconscionable.
And you know what? Another difficulty that I remember and remember so well is the level of education that kids come to the United States with, so that mm-hmm. we would sometimes have Chinese students, for example, who had a very strong educational background. They'd go and they'd say, okay, we're not taking algebra. You put me in calculus. And then we'd have kids that would come from Central America with interrupted education. So yeah. they maybe went to the eighth grade or they went to the seventh grade. And then suddenly, you know, they're 16, 17 years old. They walk through the door and you are obligated to help them get a high school diploma, as you should. But there were all of the gaps in social studies curriculum. I remember quite clearly there was no background in U.S. history from the countries yep. that the children are coming from. Most of the time, their social studies education was a very local education. And now you're put in, you know, you're technically an 11th grader. Here's U.S. history regions on top of everything else.
Yeah, currently right now we have kids who are listed in one cohort but are taking classes from three different levels. And people like me have to jump into different levels. So I'm teaching a kid who's supposed to be 11th or 12th grader, doesn't have the credits, their transcript hasn't been translated, and it's a hot chaos. I would change lots of things. But first thing is this NICE slot, the test that levels the kids, had been changed to be Common Coreified, and now it's more academic. It's not really a language-level assessment. And mm-hmm. there's not a direct match between what they're capable of doing and what they're capable of doing in the class and this test. And this test is given towards the end of the year, starting in April. We don't get the results till August. We don't get to use it to inform our instruction. It's just used for compliance and leveling. I would say the first thing is that you need to have on-demand testing to level the kids immediately, and we mm-hmm. should get those results immediately because they're supposed to inform our instruction. That's what the test should be for, period. Another thing is these kids come in and the school is responsible for doing all the intakes, and that's not fair. It's a big burden, and those kids fall through the cracks. I currently have a kid who's finally his transcript got translated, and he didn't have to take global. He spent a whole year in global. He needed a waiver. It could have been done immediately if it was done at right. the district level. If the district level would do more of this, like going deep, calling the schools in different countries and doing that translating, we can book these kids in the right classes. Another thing is we need to start thinking about, like, how do you give waivers to kids in the only state that asks for five Regents exams? Els and around the country are not facing five Regents exams. Why yeah. is New York State doing this? So there's a lot of that is a problem, but also they're coming in with their own language. We need to have a low-T Regents on demand so that those French-speaking kids can take it when they walk in and come in with one Regents underneath their belt. Open up the 4+1 pathway for graduation. All of those pathways have to be opened up to the Els, and that means the way we look at these tests has to be something that serves the kids, not serving the state. You should be able to have it immediately. I should be able to say, okay, this kid has their Regents in X, Y, and Z. Now we got to worry on the waiver and get them on the pathway to five and out. But we're not doing that. We're holding them back. We're putting them in the wrong places. Some of these kids came in with algebra and all kinds of other skills, and because they went to a summer program in my school, got those Regents. They have others who came in a little bit later, couldn't get those Regents, but already had stuff, they already have the knowledge. So we're not letting them, those who come with some skills, show the skills. And those who come with less, we don't have a plan for them. Everything is cookie cutter. And the smaller the schools are, thank you, Bloomberg, the more trouble we have
tailoring instruction to help the different subpopulations that are in our schools. And it's different borough to borough and neighborhood to neighborhood. And we need some of that flexibility in designing curriculum and designing pathways, because we get kids at different levels, including CTE, including any skills-based instruction, because these kids are overaged, undercredited. So we need a program that would serve them, would necessarily look at how to get them out and how to get them on their feet. And that's communication as well as test taking. They have to be able to speak and write and communicate in English. And we can't dismiss what the ESL teacher does as a service, because I don't give pedicures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, let me. We have just a little bit of time left. What I'd like to do now is to repeat that our phone lines are open. So if you have any questions or concerns, please give us a call at 212-209-2877. Again, 212-209-2877. So is essentially what you're saying is kind of a what should happen and what should change is to go back to a model that existed before, to maybe walk away from some of the requirements for kids to pass Regents exams in order to be able to graduate. I mean, what do you think about going back to something like the RCT exams? Should there be, I'm just curious as to what your opinion is on this, should there be any kind of tests that are required of kids before we go and we hand over the diploma? Because the argument on the other side is, the fear is, okay, we're just going to push these kids out the door. And you know there are places that would do that.
There are places that would do that. We also know that if you have literacy skills in language A, they will very quickly show themselves in language B once you get to the point in language B where you're able to do that. So we could very well be teaching these students skills that they already have in their first language. And if the students are lacking fundamental skills in their first language, we might be approaching them from a point that's way too high. Now, I do think we should move Part 154 back, because it's a backward move rather than a forward move. But if I had my druthers, I would give L's a full year of English, intensive English instruction,
yep,
before placing them in a classroom. It would only be English. There is nothing, you know, I could tell my students, this is the most important course you're taking, because you will use this stuff every day of your life, just like I'm using it now. I don't know, I mean, you're studying geometry and drawing the triangles. I'm not sure if you'll use that every day of your life. I mean, I don't use it. But to be able to speak English clearly, to be able to speak in multiple tenses, to be able to express yourself correctly and precisely, especially in writing, is really quite an advantage for anybody. And we can help them with that. And we can give them that. And if we don't give them that, I've taught college, and I know that they're going to end up in community colleges studying the things that we withheld from them in high school, paying a lot of money for courses that will give them zero credit. It just seems, yep, counterproductive and stupid, and I'm horrified by the Regents. I'm horrified by their level of ignorance, what they show us. They have no idea what these kids go through. I have seen no evidence since Merrill Tisch left of any improvement from Albany regarding L's. We moved backwards, and they're silent on it. Our school wrote a letter to Judith Chin, our local regent, to ask her to speak to us about it, which she ignored. And, I mean, I thought about getting 100 people to sign the next letter, but she'll probably ignore that, too. These things, you know, Stephen Krashen believe that comprehensible input was paramount in, and he's who we studied, probably I used to study him too. It's paramount in learning a language, and they seem to have moved past that, and I have no idea how they've moved past that. It's just so basic and so absolutely true and so indisputable, but yet I read these two books because somebody in the UFT asked me to, and they're basically expressions of common coreiness. They are not expressions of how to teach language. And they have no regard for school.
Yeah.
Back to the original question. We should put in the RCT because I have kids who are special needs and ESL cannot pass anything.
Yeah.
And we're not aiming on their skills, and they've changed the region so many times that it no longer resembles a skills-based thing. It's a whack-a-mole thing. The NISA slot has changed. So what we used to be looking for, we're no longer looking for. The NISA slot is asking kids to speak on things that are content level. So some of the prep books have stuff on geometry and have stuff on science and stuff for them to practice speaking on. And then the test will have something about simple machines, an essay about staplers.
Yeah.
These kids are not interested in it. The tests are not relevant. It's not responsive and doesn't lead to having a rigorous ESL curriculum. I would say scrap everything, respect ESL, actually develop a proper curriculum that includes what the advanced level kids need, which my kids needed TOEFL practice. You know, they needed actual polishing for college. They were ready. It just needed that advanced level instruction that an ESL teacher who is trained and has actually done the real thing can actually do, as opposed to people who are used to translating and holding up the walls and not really doing anything, because the current ESL teachers are not being trained in all the things that the older teachers knew. They don't. I had co-teachers, what's a TOEFL? What's a TOEIC? What is this? What are these international kids? Because they're going to have to register as international kids in college. Like, we really need to have that. And the word service needs to be looked at. And we need to look at how we get them out, give them the credit. Instead of giving, ESL is given elective credit under English. Elective. These kids did not elect to come to this country.
Yeah.
Taking away the opportunity to take another elective class from them is wrong. Not letting them do credit accumulation because the ESL classes hold them back, yet they're forced to take them, is an injustice.
Yeah.
So the games need to stop playing. And the same way that they supported getting content teachers stronger to teach L's, they need to have the ESL teachers get the same type of support, so that if we having our kids struggle, we can help them. We know a little bit more about the content, we can be a little bit more flexible, but we really need to have a proper curriculum and get them through the stages. The RCT will help those kids who are not passing, and the Regents needs to become an achievement test. They should no longer be required. That's my opinion. It needs to become an achievement test so that we're aiming to get these kids to know as much as possible, not aiming just to get them over that 65 line. Or in the case of my kids who are both ed and spells, they get that 55.
Yeah.
Because we're aiming for the lowest common denominator because of these obstacles.
Yeah. Well, listen, we only have a few minutes left, so just pause for 1 second. All right? Think. And you're going to tell me in about 30 seconds, maybe up to a minute, if you could talk to Betty Rosa right now, what would you say to her, Arthur? Arthur, you still with us?
Is he still there?
Whoops.
You get knocked off?
I think we lost him.
Oh, someone get him back.
Well, we only have a little bit. Well, maybe he's just so angry he doesn't want to say anything. What would you say, Aixa?
When I spoke to her the last time, she said that it wasn't their intention to have such a damage to the career path, to the kids, etc. I would tell her, really look at what would make the justice of these kids. Some of these kids are amazing and just need the help. Clear all the obstacles, clear all the pathways. Make sure that things are not so cumbersome that we can let the kids who are already spiraling up get there. And those kids who are struggling, we need to have something set up for them. Not everybody's a cookie cutter. And we need to look at Part 154, and it needs to be reimagined for what these kids are coming into. My kids speak Wolof and all these other languages. Where are those language programs?
Right.
Where are those supports? Why are we not helping those kids? Because we keep talking about Latinos, Latinos, Latinos. I'm Latino myself. All my kids are African.
Right.
So we'll talk upstate, all the other different groups, upstate is very different. So I think that they need to have a different strategy, and it needs to be not deficit-minded or deficit-focused. It needs to be about opportunities. How do you build these kids up, and how do we get them what they need? So make those pathways. That's what I would ask her.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And Arthur, I'm not sure what happened to you. It looks like the phone line dropped. I'm hoping that you're listening. Thank you very much for being on the show. You're terrific. Aixa Rodriguez, always wonderful. And I would just like to say to everybody, if you like the show, well, the way you keep it on the air is you sign up online to become a BAI buddy for Talk Out of School. That's a BAI buddy for Talk Out of School. And thank you, everybody. Muchísimas gracias y más for listening in. Next week, Lainey will be back as host right here on WBAI-FM at 10 a.m. on Wednesdays, where we always talk out of school. And boy, did we do that today. Thank you.
You finally lay your burden down. Close up your books, get out of your seat. Down the hall and into the street. Up to the corner and round the bend. Right to the juke, John, you go in. Drop the coin right into the slot. You gotta hear something that's really hot. With the one you love, you're making romance.